May it please the court, my name is Maurice Kneiser. I'm here today on behalf of Secretary of State Scott Gessler. My registration number is 5264. I'd like to address some administrative and points of interest initially that aren't essential to the outcome of the case, but I think would provide a context. First of all, Rule 4.27, which is the subject of this hearing today, has been changed. It is now Rule 4.1. This came about as a result of recodification of the rules in Secretary of State's recent rulemaking back after the briefing was completed. Second, Colorado campaign finance law is fairly dynamic. And I wanted to just bring to the court's attention two matters that are going on simultaneously with this. One, we had indicated to the court that there was a matter concerning the Secretary of State's rulemaking authority concerning the recodification of the rules. That was heard in State District Court last Friday. And there was a recent case filed in the Federal District Court challenging, among other things, Rule 4.27 and also the Colorado District Court's ruling in this particular case about the limits of the Sampson case, and that may be set for a preliminary injunction hearing in the near future. We were told that the plaintiffs would be filing tomorrow. With respect to the case presently before the court, there are two primary questions that are presented. First, to what extent did the case of Sampson versus Busher change the reporting and registration requirements for small issue committees in the state of Colorado? If the court adopts Common Cause's interpretation and holds that the Sampson ruling is limited to the parties and the facts before the Sampson court, then the provisions in the state constitution and state law with regard to issue committees remain in effect. Second, if the court determines that the secretary's interpretation of Sampson and the expansiveness of that interpretation is correct, and that the Tenth Circuit invalidated reporting requirements and registration requirements for small issue committees, then the question becomes, what is the scope of the secretary's rulemaking authority to address that particular circumstance where a court has changed or invalidated a part of the state constitution and or state statute?
If there are two possible interpretations of Sampson, why wouldn't we default to the principle of constitutional avoidance, which we would apply in interpreting a statute? So we would interpret Sampson in a way that did not invalidate any existing provision of the Colorado Constitution or Colorado statutes.
I'm not sure that the doctrine of avoidance would require or would necessitate the result that you reach, because even if you take the narrow interpretation, the fact of the matter remains is that the Court of Appeals in that case did declare it unconstitutional. The question is the expansiveness of that. Secondly, with respect to the question of the scope, I think the recent holdings by the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, in Citizens United, argues for a more expansive interpretation. If you adopt the interpretation that it applies only to the plaintiffs, what the court would end up doing is essentially say to anybody who has a fact situation that's not quite similar, that you have to go ahead and litigate that fact situation. You would then be subject to the complaints as the Sampson people were. You would be subject to the same type of administrative burden that the court found to be oppressive and to be a violation of the right of association. I think would also be inconsistent with this court's ruling in the Sanger case and the scope of an as-applied challenge. In the Sanger case, the court ruled that in an as-applied challenge, the as-applied challenge applies not only to the specific facts of the case, but also to similar context. And the reason for that is to prevent future applications of the law in an unconstitutional manner. The court in Sanger actually referred to a quote from Justice Scalia in which he indicated that the as-applied challenge goes beyond the particular facts of the case and applies to similar contexts. The real issue as we see it in this case is what is a similar context? And that to us really defines the what this case is about.
Mr. Kneiser, I'd like to ask you a question about the impact of Sampson as being a Tenth Circuit case. Because as a Tenth Circuit case, it may be persuasive authority for the courts of Colorado. What is its impact on Secretary of State?
Well, Secretary of State is bound by Sampson. Secretary of State was the defendant in Sampson. Secretary of State was the one who litigated the case. And so we are bound by the Tenth Circuit's ruling. We have no choice. One of the problems that we face in this context, and part of the reason I brought up some of the other litigation that's going on, is we are in somewhat of a bind because we are subject to the Tenth Circuit's ruling as a defendant in the case. This court is not necessarily subject to the Tenth Circuit's ruling, but we would hope for some consistency between and among the courts, because the worst case scenario, not only for the Secretary of State, who's really more of an administrator, but really for the people who have to comply with the law, is that we end up with two contrary rulings. One from this court saying that the Sampson case is limited to the plaintiffs and the peculiar facts of that case. And the other is really the position we're advocating. We think what the Tenth Circuit said was that, in fact, it's broader than that. It applies not only to the Sampson plaintiffs and annexation elections, but also to similar contexts, that is, small issue committees where the cost of complying with the reporting requirements is near or exceeds the value of the financial contributions or expenditures that were made. And so that's how, that is really kind of the framework of the case.
Only follow up Judge Lichtenstein's point. I mean, under principles of res judicata, Mr. Gessler is bound by Sampson. But if he were to if that issue were to be relitigated by some other small issue committee, there wouldn't be any res judicata effect, would there?
Well, you know, res judicata may apply. Well.
Well, let me back up and ask a broader question. I think let me make explicit what was implicit in Judge Lichtenstein's question. We have a number of cases holding that we are not bound by any federal court decision below that of the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, isn't the same true of Mr. Gessler, except to the extent of the reach of a principle such as res judicata?
Not necessarily.
Why not?
Because let's look at it in the context of civil rights lawsuits. In a civil rights lawsuit, somebody in the secretary's position would be subject to official or qualified immunity unless the case law was very clear that it applied to that particular individual. So in this particular case, despite I think some of the technicalities that you've talked about in terms of res judicata, we believe that in order to comply with some of the requirements, for example, with regard to qualified immunity, we would have to follow the Tenth Circuit's law in order to make sure that the Secretary of State, for example, does not abrogate his qualified immunity. So in the context of constitutional requirements, this is not a case, for example, I was listening to the prior argument, where you've got specific facts limited to specific cases. This is a case of constitutional significance that affects the associational rights of the citizens of the state of Colorado. And in order to properly enforce the law, we think that the secretary would be bound by the holding in the Sampson case. In qualified immunity cases, it's not just the narrow facts of the case. It is whether the law applies to something more than just the narrow facts of the case, because we can't pick and choose among plaintiffs or facts. We have to look to the constitutional significance of the case law.
Isn't that a fairly high standard? I mean, in terms of
you know, whether the, and I can't remember the U.S. Supreme Court case, but in terms of whether the principle is sufficient, is articulated with sufficient clarity that no reasonable government official could come to the contrary conclusion. I mean, isn't that about what it says?
That's the sum and substance of the, you know, of the immunity issue.
Do you think one decision meets that test?
Yes, because it would be different if that decision was in a different circuit. But in the Tenth Circuit, for example, in Wilson versus Stocker, which was an immunity case, what the court basically said was that if there's a Tenth Circuit case or a U.S. Supreme Court case, then the parties who were the people who were parties to that case or public officials who were within that jurisdiction must comply with that particular holding. So I think under those circumstances, it would be necessary for the Secretary of State to comply with that requirement.
Well, let me ask you, as far as the Secretary complying and the enforcement piece of it, if there were a complaint that were filed, does not the Secretary merely refer it to an ALJ?
The Secretary does refer it under most circumstances to an ALJ, not always. For example, with certain reporting requirements, the Secretary of State is the one who has responsibility. So, for example, if an issue committee or a political committee does not file in time, the Secretary is the one who has jurisdiction over that. But you're correct. In most other instances, it is the private party who enforces that. So what I want to see, I'm past 10 minutes, so I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Jennifer Hunt with Hill and Robbins, and I am here representing Colorado Common Cause. With me at council table is Luis Toro and Margaret Pearl, representing Ethics Watch. Although I don't think this was necessarily the secretary's position at the trial court below, it now appears that both sides agree on a key point. The Tenth Circuit in Sampson held that Colorado's registration and reporting requirements for issue committees cannot be enforced in situations that are factually similar to the Sampson plaintiffs. And this is consistent with the trial court's order. The only question is then is whether the secretary has the authority to raise the threshold, the $200 threshold in the Constitution for all issue committees in an attempt to address the limited application of the Sampson ruling. I don't think the secretary disputes that he has only the authority to promulgate rules as may be necessary to administer and enforce the campaign finance laws. The deference that the secretary asks for, however, is not appropriate. While agencies are entitled to deference in their reasonable interpretations of governing constitutional and statutory provisions, such deference does not allow them to enact rules that directly contradict constitutional and statutory provisions. This is an issue where the agency has technical expertise that must be deferred to, which would be the case, you know, if we were talking about what kind of voting machines to use or what forms to file or how to file them. The courts, not the Secretary of State, has the expertise and the authority to interpret the scope of the First Amendment. So we don't need to decide whether the Secretary has any ability to tailor rules to comply to judicial rulings, because that's not what the Secretary did here. What we are saying and what the trial court held is that the Secretary of State cannot take a limited, as-applied judicial ruling, apply a broader interpretation to it, and then use rulemaking to rewrite constitutional and statutory provisions that have not been struck down. So the question then is whether the Sampson decision can reasonably be interpreted as applying so broadly as to support a rule that clearly contradicts Article 28, Section 210A, and the Fair Campaign Practices Act disclosure provisions. And I submit the answer is clearly no. And how do we know this? The Sampson opinion itself tells us at 1249 of the opinion, it's, quote, "We agree that Colorado law, as applied to plaintiffs, has violated their constitutional freedom of association." There are a couple other places. At 1254, the court states, quote, "We agree with the as-applied First Amendment argument, holding that Colorado registration and reporting requirements have unconstitutionally burdened their First Amendment right of association." And because of that ruling, the court expressly declined to address the facial challenge to the reporting and disclosure system that had been asserted by the plaintiffs. And then, of course, the the ultimate holding of the case at 1261, we therefore hold that it was unconstitutional to impose that burden on plaintiffs. We do not attempt to draw a bright line below which a ballot issue committee cannot be required to report contributions and expenditures. And then later goes on to say, we say only that plaintiffs' contributions and expenditures are well below the line. So the court took an individualistic approach, determining that on the facts of the case, considering the amount spent, the nature of the issue, and the whole factual situation at issue with the Sampson plaintiffs, Colorado's reporting and registration system was too burdensome and impinged on their constitutional rights. And the factual situation of those plaintiffs was important to the analysis. The determining factor in applying the issue committee regulations isn't therefore just the amount or the level of the threshold, but the relationship between that threshold and the amount at issue and the nature of the issue involved. This is not a one size fits all approach, as the Secretary would prefer. Instead, requires a case-by-case evaluation, balancing the burdens of compliance with the state interest in requiring disclosure. So we submit that Sampson did not invalidate the entire disclosure and reporting system for issue committees. As the court said in Sanger versus Dennis, which Mr. Kneiser alluded to a minute ago, the practical effect of holding a statute unconstitutional as applied is to prevent its future application in a similar context, but not to render it utterly inoperative. I also point the court to Section 14 of Article 28 itself, which states that any application of that is determined to be unconstitutional does not mean other applications are unconstitutional.
Let me ask you this, because the Secretary is stating that under Sampson, there is a statement that, well, when expenditures and contributions would essentially be too low and create too much of a burden to require the reporting requirements, that is your line. And so I understand the Secretary to say, look, we did these hearings and we did this data compilation and we found out what that line is, and so therefore it comports with Sampson. So I just want to hear your response to that.
Right. I think the problem is that, you know, while it may be true that the Sampson court called into question the applicability of the $200 threshold to certain small issue committees and certain issues, the rule removes that threshold for all issue committees across the board. The Secretary is using the threshold of regulation as a proxy for the more nuanced analysis that's required under Sampson, which it's not just the $200. It's the kind of issue. It's a small annexation issue. The court, the Tenth Circuit expressly said at 1261 in its ultimate holding that the case before us is quite unlike ones involving the expenditure of tens of millions of dollars on ballot issues presenting complex policy proposals. In that kind of situation, the $200 threshold would not be unconstitutional. It would not be too much of a burden on a committee like that. And I think that is what the Rule 4.27 gets wrong and is overreaching. It deals just with one aspect of the Sampson holding, not the entire analysis that the Tenth Circuit did. In the reply brief, the Secretary states in page 18 that the rule does not excuse any group from complying with the threshold because Sampson removes the $200 threshold along with all other reporting requirements for issue committees. And I think that's just a misstatement of what Sampson did. It's contrary to that, the Secretary's suggestion, the $2,200 at issue in the Sampson case would not be below the line, using the Sampson court's terminology, of constitutional regulation in other kinds of contexts. Like I just mentioned, the large committees on large complex issues. Now, any notion that this Rule 4.27 was intended simply to apply the Sampson ruling narrowly is belied by paragraph A of the rule, which has not been discussed yet, in which the Secretary mostly ignores in the briefing. After setting the $5,000 threshold for all issue committees, paragraph A of the rule exempts the first $4,999 of contributions and expenditures from any disclosure or reporting requirements. Now, this is just clear overreaching, in violation of the Fair Campaign Practices Act, Section 145.108, 1A1, which requires all issue committees to report all contributions, the names and addresses of all contributors who contribute $20 or more, and all expenditures. There's nothing in the Sampson ruling to support allowing some contributions to and expenditures by issue committees to be kept secret even after the committee reaches the threshold, whatever that threshold might be. As the trial court pointed out in its order on page 8, such disclosure cannot be too burdensome because committees would have to keep track of the money in order to know when they reached the threshold in the first place. The briefing here on this appeal did not offer any real basis for this loophole or any legal authority allowing the promulgation of such a rule. The only discussion is in the reply brief at page 17, where the argument is made that plaintiffs did not raise the issue in their opening briefs, and the court did not focus on it. And I feel it's necessary to point out that it was included. It was a separate claim for relief, a second claim for relief in our complaint. It was dealt with extensively in our briefing, and it was addressed by the trial court at oral argument and on page 8 of his order. Just wanted to clear that up. And so at the very least, that paragraph A of the rule 4.27 has absolutely no basis in Sampson or anywhere else.
Let me ask you about the Secretary stating that because it is bound by Sampson, that essentially it was required to pass such a rule in order to comply.
You know, I think the answer to that is whether or not the Secretary is bound by the 10th Circuit decision in future cases. The fact that the Sampson delineated a test or looked at these particular facts and how the scheme burdens these particular kinds of plaintiffs and this kind of thing does not give him the authority to rewrite the constitutional provisions that weren't affected, does not give him the authority to change the threshold for all committees regardless of size. Again, I believe it's conflating the size of the committee and the threshold of the regulation, which is not supported by Sampson. I think the FEC versus Massachusetts Citizens for Life case is instructive here. The Secretary argues that Sampson is like the MCFL case and therefore supports his rulemaking as a gap-filling measure. I think he's half right. Sampson is much like MCFL, but it doesn't support the position he's taking here. Like Sampson, MCFL involved an as-applied ruling that the broad prohibition in federal statutes at the time on corporate spending on express advocacy was unconstitutional as applied to certain kinds of corporations, nonprofit corporations that are really issue-oriented, not for-profit. MCFL did not invalidate the entire statute. Instead, the Supreme Court carved out very specific circumstances under which the statute could not be applied, a multi-factor test, if you will. Importantly, that the court did the line drawing, not the agency. The FEC later codified this multi-factor test as it was set forth in the court. But here, in contrast, the Secretary has taken it upon himself to do the line drawing that the 10th Circuit was not willing to do. It is the role of the court to interpret the Constitution, not the executive branch, and the role of the legislature to write the laws if they need to be changed. It's worth pointing out that, in fact, the General Assembly has exercised its judgment to ameliorate some of the concerns raised by the Sampson plaintiffs. And they did that before the 10th Circuit decision was even issued. The statute was amended to clarify when a municipal annexation question becomes a ballot issue for purposes of campaign finance law. And it was the passage of House Bill 10-1370 mandated that the Secretary notify proponents of a ballot issue when, at a certain point when their ballot issue is approved, that they'll be subject to regulation. So some of the concerns raised by the Sampson Court have been addressed by the General Assembly, as they properly should. That is their role. And let me just state, because Mr. Kneiser mentioned the Citizens United case, I want to just touch on that briefly. Make clear, Citizens United did not eliminate the difference between facial and as-applied challenges. The Supreme Court in that case simply said, when First Amendment rights are at issue, a court need not be bound by a litigant's choice to assert only an as-applied challenge. The court can review the facial constitutionality of a provision even when the plaintiff doesn't request it. But that is not what the 10th Circuit did in Sampson. Whether or not they could, they didn't do it. The Supreme Court did not do away with as-applied challenges. And acknowledged, in fact, that the distinction is necessary because it goes to the breadth of the remedy, and here the remedy was to declare this unconstitutional as applied to these plaintiffs. The Secretary's office could certainly do more to streamline the reporting requirements and lessen the burdens on citizens who wish to form issue committees. What he cannot do, however, is unilaterally take it upon himself to promulgate a rule that contradicts clear constitutional language that has not been declared unconstitutional. The trial court correctly held in this case that Rule 4.27 exceeds the Secretary's authority and is therefore arbitrary, capricious, and contrary to law. And unless the court has any other questions, thank you for your time.
In the course of her argument, Ms. Hill basically talks about the fact that it appears, as I understood her argument, that somehow the threshold was the key focus of the Tenth Circuit's decision in the Sampson case. In fact, what the court ruled in that case was not just limited to the threshold, the $200 threshold. The court talked about the entire scheme, the entire regimen. So it talked about not only the low threshold, but it talked about the complex and difficult reporting requirements. It talked about the fact that sometimes these folks had to hire accountants or attorneys to figure out what the rules were. And they were subject to potential complaints filed in which they had to hire attorneys. So they did not focus on the threshold. What the Secretary did in his rulemaking was to say the way to resolve the concerns that the Tenth Circuit expressed about the whole regime was to focus on the threshold, because if you raise the threshold, then to a point where the balance is in favor of the public's knowledge, then you have solved the problem that the Tenth Circuit has recognized.
Why is it necessary to solve it by precluding any look back that would make contributions prior to $5,000 reportable once the threshold was met?
Well, I think there are two responses to that. One is that, in fact, the Secretary was sort of looking at the whole regime. So basically what it said was for small issue committees, they really shouldn't have to start counting or doing bookkeeping until they reach that threshold. Now,
they have to do some bookkeeping to know when they get to the threshold?
Some bookkeeping. And I think that's the key thing. There's much more that's required for purposes of reporting than just kind of figuring out the amount that you got or the amount that you expended. In theory, small committees don't necessarily have to track who they got it from or to whom they gave it. They could just write something in a check register and indicate that they've reached that $5,000 threshold. But let's assume that the court disagrees with that. It seems to me that that particular provision would be severable. The court could end up saying, yes, the $5,000 threshold is appropriate, but the people would have to report their first $5,000, that is the amount that led up to the $5,000. So I don't think that's necessarily crucial to the outcome.
Let me ask you a response to what was just stated about it's really the role of the courts or the role of the legislature and not the executive to hit that other piece of it, which is the threshold.
Well, you know, in certain circumstances, I think that would be true, except that under Article 28, Section 9, Subsection 1B, the Constitution itself talks about the fact that the Secretary has the obligation to pass rules to enforce and administer the law. So what was clear, assuming that the court adopts our interpretation of Sampson, is that you had issue committees that needed to report, except that there really wasn't any definition. So in order to enforce and administer the law, the Secretary had to come up with rules and regulations to do so. And that's exactly what happened. I would analogize the case to the case we cited in our brief, the Elizondo case, where there was a general delegation to the Department of Revenue to pass rules. There was a broad statement of what the law was, but there was a necessity for the entity to pass rules to implement the law, and that's exactly what happened here after the decision was issued in the Sampson case. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.